Good afternoon or good morning, depending on your time zone. My name is Jean Balance. I work here in EPA Superfund program, and I'll be helping to moderate the online broadcast for the Clue and Internet seminar, which is scheduled to run from 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern, and has been sponsored by EPA's OSWER office, that's the Solid Waste and Emergency Response. Today's Clue and Internet seminar will cover addressing the potential liabilities associated with siting renewable energy on contaminated lands. This is a reminder, if you're on the phones, go ahead and mute that phone line. I can still hear some activity of people moving the phones around. Again, it's using your own mute button or star 6 to mute the line. A reminder for all of the participants today, with all Clue and Internet seminars, each individual participant will be responsible for taking a look at or accessing the seminar materials and then manually moving through the materials at verbal cues from the instructors. Again, if you're on the phone lines, please mute the phone. You can use your own mute button or hit star 6, because I can hear a side conversation. Someone just said, oh, no. So, again, star 6 to mute your line if you could. Thank you. Again, if you haven't downloaded a copy of the presentation materials, you can access those from the seminar homepage, which you would have seen when you signed up, as well as been given through a number of confirmation and reminder email messages. You can either click the button that says Go to Seminar to look at the slides in a web browser window, or you could follow the links as well to download the slides that appears at the bottom of the seminar homepage as either PowerPoint or PDF. I'm going to ask everybody, if you are looking at the slides, either printed out or electronically, to go ahead and move ahead from slide number 1, which is our title slide, on to slide number 2 for some basic reminders and housekeeping items. Again, if you are on the phone lines, please keep the call muted. We do not want you to put the call on hold. There could be background music or commercials that's disruptive. You can use your own mute button or hit star 6 to mute your line. We're going to hold questions until the end of the formal presentation, and at that time, I'll remind you that you can unmute your line and actually ask questions by phone. But until then, we do ask you keep yourself muted, hit star 6 to mute your line. For those of you that are streaming the audio online or looking at the slides through a web browser window, you'll be able to navigate through the slides using the numbered links that appear on the left-hand slide or by simply clicking the orange icons that appear along the top of your slides. The single arrow pointing to the right will move you forward one slide. The single arrow to the left will move you backwards one slide. You can also submit questions electronically. You can click the question mark icon that appears at the top of the slides if you're looking at them in a web browser window. And as long as your pop-up blocker has been disabled, a new window will open up where you can actually type up your comment or question. You don't have to wait until the end of the seminar to do that. In fact, we would encourage you to submit questions electronically at any point in time. But we would, again, remind you that we won't actually address those questions until we get to the end of the formal presentation materials, and we'll alternate between phone and electronic questions. One of the other reminders to everyone today is that today's session is being recorded. In about 1 to 2 weeks, you guys will automatically receive an email from me, which will give you not only the links to download the materials, but also options to replay the recording for free online. And you're welcome to forward that information to any colleague or coworker that you think will find it useful. You can certainly go now to the current Clue and Archive, where we have almost 400 different Clue and Internet seminars, which is available for you to browse through for free if you'd like to look at some of the other sessions we've already offered on these or related topics. And I believe that is the end of the formal reminders that I have for everybody today. Since it looks like we have synced up with everybody, I'm going to ask everyone again to turn the page, moving on to slide number 3. And at this point, I'm going to turn things over to Laura Matthews from OSWER Center for Program Analysis.
I'm sorry, this is Donna. Could you tell me where I could go to the slides?
Donna, when you registered for the seminar, you would have been directed to a seminar homepage. On that seminar homepage, there's a button that says to go to the seminar online, or there are links at the bottom of that page to download the slides. You also would have been given that same information in a confirmation email and a reminder email as well.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome. Laura, if you're ready.
Okay, great. Thanks, Jean. My name is Laura Matthews. I lead up EPA's Repowering America's Land Initiative. This is the initiative that promotes the siting of renewable energy on potentially contaminated land and mining sites. So before we get into the liability discussion, from Elizabeth and a case study from Amy. I want to give folks a little bit of background on the Repowering Initiative, the opportunities for renewable energy on contaminated sites in the U.S., and to tell you a little bit about what EPA is doing to promote renewable energy on contaminated sites. So specifically, moving on to slide 4, I will give background on Repowering America's Land, talk about why renewable energy on contaminated lands makes sense, tell you a little bit about our existing repowering tools, some feasibility studies we're conducting with Department of Energy's National Renewable Energy Lab, some of the upcoming projects and assistance we'll be providing from EPA, and give you an example of a success story. So moving on to slide 5, the Repowering Initiative has been around for about 3 years now. This is part of EPA's cleanup programs to clean up and revitalize contaminated sites. So there's potential on brownfield sites, Superfund sites, abandoned mine lands, worker corrective action sites, and landfills. So to date, we have mapped over 15 million acres of contaminated land. That's about 11,000 contaminated sites, and we've overlaid that with the renewable energy potential for those sites. So moving on to slide 6, why does renewable energy on contaminated lands make sense? So depending on the contaminated site and also the community, if they're interested in renewable energy, contaminated sites have a lot of advantages that green space sites may not have. They often have existing infrastructure in place, transmission lines, roads, railways, and because these sites are often vacant, the transmission line may have excess capacity on it that could be used for renewable energy. Additionally, we found that there may be lower transaction costs to using these sites. If you're looking for a really big parcel of land, there are a lot of abandoned mine lands and very large Superfund sites that have one owner, and so it may be easier to put together large projects than examples where you have to get together a bunch of different landowners. We've also seen a number of cases that there's improved public support and faster permitting and zoning. Because these sites have been are often abandoned and vacant for a number of years, communities are often excited to see the potential redevelopment opportunity on these sites and are willing to move projects along faster to ensure that they have a redevelopment option for that site. And in addition to the redevelopment opportunity for these sites, communities can be excited about renewable energy on these sites because it increases the economic value of the property for them. It furthers environmental sustainability in their community by maximizing land use. It reduces the stress on green fields. It provides clean energy for use either on-site, locally, or to the grid, and it may create local jobs. So moving on to slide 7, I want to show you the potential for renewable energy on contaminated sites. So you can see from this graph here, all those little dots are different types of contaminated sites, and there is a huge potential for solar on contaminated sites. Of the 11,000 sites that we've screened the solar potential for, we found large utility-scale potential at 470 sites, and policy-driven PV potential at almost 1,400 sites. And so we're differentiating policy-driven PV as solar potential in states that may not have the highest level of solar resource, but instead are in a state with great solar incentives, such as New Jersey and Massachusetts. There's also opportunity on all of contaminated sites potentially for non-grid connected PV. And we also have a number of very large sites in the Southwest that have potential for concentrated solar power. Moving on to slide 8, this is a similar graph for wind potential. So you can see that there are a number of sites in contaminated sites in the country with potential for wind. So about 37 very large sites with potential for utility wind, smaller scale projects at about 170 sites, and then projects that may not be as close to the grid. It looks like there are about 1,300 sites where there's wind potential, resource potential, but there may not be a transmission line nearby. Moving on to slide 9, I'd like to tell you a little bit about some of the tools we offer at EPA to help folks who are interested in putting renewable energy on contaminated sites. One of our tools that has been really helpful in finding potential sites is our Google Earth mapping tool. So all those sites I just showed you in those pretty static maps, we also have them available in a Google Earth mapping tool, and I'll talk to you more about those in just a minute. We also offer technical assistance on a limited basis with help from Department of Energy's National Renewable Energy Lab. We also have information on success stories and case studies online that talk about how projects were developed and barriers that were overcame for those projects. We also have information on incentives on our website. So on a state-by-state basis, what brownfields incentives can you get for cleaning up and revitalizing properties, and what renewable energy incentives are available for each state. So all of that can be found on our website, which is located at the bottom of slide 9, www.epa.gov/renewableenergyland. Moving on to slide 10, we worked with Department of Energy's National Renewable Energy Lab to screen 11,000 contaminated sites that we had lat-long data for. And just to let you guys know, that's just a small sampling of the contaminated sites across the country. GAO estimates that there are over 400,000 brownfield properties alone across the country. And so one thing we're working to do is incorporate more brownfield sites that we don't currently have data on our website for into our Google Earth tool. So we use the lat-long data and the acreage data from our 11,000 sites. We then worked with NREL on the resource data for different types of renewable energy, and we overlaid that with infrastructure data for how close these sites were to transmission lines, roads, and railways. So moving on to slide 11, here is a picture of what the Google Earth mapping tool looks like. So you can see up in the left-hand corner there, EPA tracked sites. There's a little dot and a color associated with each different type of site. So if you are just interested in brownfield properties, you can click on the other types of sites so they go, so they don't show up. And it looks like a little bit of my screenshot over on the left got cut off there. But what you have to the left of this map is a toolbar where you can select the type of renewable energy you're interested. So if you just are looking at concentrated solar power or wind or photovoltaic, you can click on that type of renewable energy and just those sites will come up. And then if you're looking for a particular type of property, like a Superfund site or a landfill, you can also click on that to limit the search for just those types of sites you're interested in. So if everyone moves to slide 12, this is a, I just zoomed in on the Google Earth to Arizona. So you can zoom in even closer than this and really actually get a feel for what the site looks like from above. So you can see, you know, does it look like it's flat? Are there any buildings or trees in the way that would make it difficult to put the type of renewable energy you're interested on that? And then when you click on any one of these little dots, a pop-up box comes up with more information on that site. So if we move to slide 13, you'll see an example here. So just to show you all the information that's available in this pop-up box on Google Earth, this site, you can see near the top, it says the name of the landfill. It tells you where it's located. It also has the acreage. So you can see this one is 140 acres. It's a brownfield property. And then in that box near the top of the page, it has the renewable energy potential based on our, you know, very basic screening criteria. So you can just get a sense there of what different types of renewable energy may be possible on this site. And then below that box, we have more specific information, such as how close it is to transmission lines, what the wind resource potential is, et cetera. And then going back up towards the top of the box, there's a link that says cleanup program information. When you click on that link, a website will open up, and that has even more information about the site. It has specific information about who you can contact at EPA about that site. It usually has information about who the current owner of the property is and how to contact them, and it often has information about how far along the site is in the cleanup process. In addition to having all this information available on Google Earth, where you can click on sites one by one, we also have this available in an Excel file on our website and also a shape file. So if you want to screen a bunch of sites and look for all sites that are more than 50 acres in California, you can do that. So you can sort the data in Excel or access the data in any way you'd like in the shape file. So moving on to slide 14, one thing that we've been working on, we partnered with the Department of Energy's National Renewable Energy Lab to do some site-specific analyses of contaminated sites. So in 2010, we began the process to conduct 12 site-specific feasibility studies. So now that it's summer of 2011, we have a number of those projects that are completed. Most of the solar projects are very near completed, their feasibility studies. The wind studies will take a little bit longer because anemometers have been put up, and so we need to collect the wind data for a year before completing the feasibility studies. But the analysis includes determining the best renewable energy technology for the site, where on the site is the best place for that technology, how much energy could be generated, how much the project would cost, the return on the investment, and the economic feasibility of the particular project. So the outcome of this is a tool for that local community to use if they want to determine whether they want to move forward in trying to seek developers for that site. And as I mentioned, we did 12 site-specific analyses beginning in 2010, and just a few months ago we put out a RFP to select more sites for feasibility studies. So that was due last month, and we're currently in the process of selecting hopefully about 20 more projects to begin in the future. And at this time, we're not sure if we're going to have the funding to do another round of RFPs. But, these feasibility studies will hopefully be useful to communities, even if they didn't receive the feasibility study, to learn more about, you can look at a landfill project that's been done in your state and find out more about what the challenges may be and what the expected costs would be for a property. So moving on to slide 15, in addition to all the tools and resources I've told you about, a couple things we're looking to do in the future that I think will be very useful to folks. We're developing a solar on landfill guidance, and again, we're working with the National Renewable Energy Lab to help with this, and I think we're hoping to have a draft of that out this fall. We're also working on developing more detailed case studies that really get into what barriers were at that site. Was there any difficulty because the site was contaminated? Were there any liability issues? And talk about how those were overcome. We're also conducting a webinar series, of which this is a part of, and we're hoping to have one every 3 months or so. We're working to clarify liability protections at EPA, which is Elizabeth will talk about the fact sheet that we developed that hopefully get that clarifying those liability protections. And we'll also be taking steps in the future to take a look at our existing liability tools and make sure that those are appropriate for renewable energy and see if there's any others we need to develop. We're also looking to add some of those state track brownfield sites that we don't have in our database to our Google Earth tool. And then we're also looking to expand our federal partnership, Department of Energy and federal agencies that have contaminated sites, work with them to promote renewable energy and contaminated lands in their program. And on slide 16, I just wanted to give you an example of a successful project that was developed. This is the Aerojet Solar Project in Sacramento, California. This was developed on a Superfund site that is a large Superfund site, and it's still being cleaned up. There's pump and treat for contaminated groundwater that will go on for a very long time. And so the owner of the site, Aerojet, looked at a parcel of land that didn't have any ground contamination and also didn't have active pump and treat going on, and they were able to develop 6 megawatts on 40 acres. So they worked with EPA to, you know, figure out where's the best place to put the solar panels. So I think they came to our EPA office in San Francisco and said, here's where we'd like to put the panels. And then EPA said, okay, well, for the most part, this looks good, but can we move this a little ways over here so that we can make sure we can access the groundwater monitoring well? So EPA and Aerojet worked very well together on that project. And even at a six megawatt project, only powers 30% of the energy used for the cleanup of that site. So even though they're just doing groundwater cleanup, that actually has a very large energy footprint. And so the 6 megawatts is able to help provide the energy for that and doesn't even come close to meeting the whole energy need of that site. So there's opportunity on these sites to connect to the grid or to have, or to provide energy to cleanup operations going on site or for buildings that are operating on site. And so with that, slide 17 has my contact information, and it once again has the link to the Repowering America's Land website. And so with that, I'll turn it over to Elizabeth so she can really get into the heart of the discussion about how EPA addresses liability concerns.
Thanks, Laura. Well, as Laura said, my name is Elizabeth Creed, and I work in the Office of Site Remediation Enforcement. And if everybody could turn to slide 19. This is basically the overview of what I plan to cover, to talk about how in OSRE we work with offices like Laura, with folks like Laura, to balance enforcement and reuse of property, and then talk about statutory liability protections and our enforcement discretion guidances, which actually we've been working on for many, many years, and then talk about some site-specific tools. I wanted to start off this discussion, if you look at the bottom of the slide, you'll see two pictures, and this is one of our success stories, and the press release is due any time now, but this is a site, a mining site in Park City, Utah. And what we did, we entered into a prospective lessee agreement with a developer to provide liability protection in exchange for the developer agreeing to complete the cleanup actions and commit to sustainable reuse of the site. And so part of the green and sustainable reuse is that the developer it's now called the Montage Resort and Spa. It's a green building. I think it's LEED certified. And the developer also included, throughout the whole design and construction process, features actions that would reduce the environmental footprint as well as initiate sustainability features such as native vegetation, conservation of open space, use of wind-generated power, an extensive recycling program, and also providing affordable housing for resort workers. If you'll turn to slide 20. Normally, people don't think of enforcement as a way to help initiatives like Laura's, where we get a really positive benefit of renewable energy or a positive reuse. But we found that enforcement has actually been a beneficial, has created beneficial tools to facilitate the reuse of properties. And so normally my office, we have two mantras. First is enforcement first. And the second is the polluter pays. When Congress wrote the RCRA and CERCLA statutes, they were very strong in the idea that those who were responsible for contamination would clean it up. And so that's pretty much the mission statement of my office. We found that there are significant benefits associated with reuse, however, and so we've been very fortunate that our tools have helped the cause, And we found that developers have been very interested in utilizing some of these tools, such as PPAs and comfort letters, because they can help it provides an incentive for expeditious cleanup. It can actually lead to a more cost-effective cleanup because we're tailoring the cleanup to that specific reuse. And the developers have been able to incorporate the reuse component and the cleanup component and reducing costs that way as well. We found that we actually get better remedies. It helps us to implement institutional controls such as deed restrictions, and obviously it helps communities by reducing blight, increasing property values. It also addresses issues that are important to us, such as preserving green space and reducing sprawl. And through this whole reuse process, we're able to work closely with partners like LURA to help facilitate a complete dialogue and really enhance our work in the enforcement office. So if you go on to slide 21, as LURA mentioned, we have her office had put together a series of community meetings, listening sessions that were focused on renewable energy use at contaminated sites. And out of that, they learned that there was some confusion about liability and liability protections. And although, as I mentioned, we've been working on this for quite some time, we've had a great partnership with our Brownfields office, with Superfund Redevelopment Initiative and other initiatives such as those, somehow the message hadn't gone out to the renewable energy developers. So LURA started working on this liability fact sheet and came to our office for assistance, and so we issued this, and back in March, this joint citing renewable energy on contaminated properties fact sheet. And that was, I think, a really successful effort. We worked closely with all of our regional offices as well as states, and I think came up with a really good document. And what was interesting about this is that none of this information is new information. However, we repackaged it to focus on renewable energy. And the fact sheet provides basically a liability 101 about enforcement discretion policy, statutory, and some of the site-specific tools that we have. And so, as LURA mentioned, one of the next steps is to sit down, hopefully this summer, and look at other existing enforcement discretion policies that we have in place and see if there's something that we could use there and tailor it towards the renewable in the renewable energy context. Okay, so slide 22. Now, as I mentioned, we've been working on liability issues for a really long time, actually since the late 1980s. We were getting questions and people were getting pulled into the CERCLA liability scheme, even though they had nothing or very little to do with the actual property or the contamination itself. So back in the 1980s, we started working on things like the municipal solid waste guidance, contaminated aquifer policy, et cetera. And then the Brownfields program came into the, and we started working on guidances to help those folks as well, such as the comfort letter policy and the prospective purchaser agreement guidance. Congress realized that they needed to do something as well, and so they came along in 2002 and introduced the Brownfields Amendments, which codified everything that we had been working on and protected innocent landowners. And we've now adopted the approach that since Congress has codified these the Brownfield Amendments, those capture the bulk of the typical land transactions that would occur, and so we don't really need to focus on that so much anymore, except in extreme cases. So we've continued to look at our at some of the liability issues that arise, and we continue to address those liability issues through enforcement discretion guidances. And then we also, as in the case of the first slide with Empire Canyon, we work on utilizing our enforcement discretion and develop site-specific enforcement tools. If you'll go to slide 23. When we developed the liability fact sheet for renewable energy investors, we did that knowing that there seemed to be some information gap and wanted to focus our, because we felt that we already had a breadth of information and options out there that renewable energy developers could really tap into. And so we felt like we had the 2002 amendments, and then we had the this liability fact sheet. And so it's our hope that one of the take-home messages that I'm hoping that you'll get is that really it's going to be the rare circumstance when you're going to need EPA involvement because of these other options that you have out there, and that most transactions are going to occur at the state and local level. If you'll turn to slide 24, please. The Brownfields Amendment of 2002 provided a number of liability protections for parties who owned contaminated property and did not cause or contribute to the contamination. I think the most important component of that is the bona fide prospective purchaser, where that protects a person or a tenant who purchases property with knowledge of contamination, provided that they meet certain threshold criteria, and as long as they continue to ensure that they do not cause or contribute to contamination after they purchase the property. Some of the threshold criteria for bona fide prospective purchasers are that they acquire the property after January 11, 2002, that the disposal occurred before the purchase, that they conduct all appropriate inquiries, and there are specific criteria that relate to what all appropriate inquiries constitute, and that the BFPP must not be potentially liable or affiliated with any person who is potentially liable for the site response costs. The prospective purchaser also has to meet continuing obligations, and those include that they take reasonable steps to prevent releases, that they cooperate and provide access to their property, and that they comply with land use restrictions, and that they not do anything that impedes the effectiveness or integrity of the remedy or institutional controls. So as I mentioned earlier, we have been working on enforcement discretion policies and guidances since the late 1980s. And some of those, as you can see on the slide, include a policy statement. That was just an affirmation of what Congress had implemented or instituted through the Brownfield Amendments of 2002. We also worked on various other guidances, like the Common Elements Guidance and Model Reasonable Steps Comfort Letter, which basically are tools that we give to prospective purchasers so that they know what they need to do to comply, to meet the bona fide prospective purchaser standard. And we've also worked on a model removal AOC. This is where, as I mentioned in the Empire Canyon site, that developer agreed to complete the cleanup work. And so the model removal AOC is something that we use. That's administrative order and consent, sorry. That's something that we use to negotiate with the developer to undertake the remaining work. If you'll turn to slide 26. In the situation of Empire Canyon, we also used what we call site-specific tools. And that's where we take some of our enforcement discretion guidances or policies and in the case of the Empire Canyon, we actually entered into a lessee agreement that supports with the prospective purchaser agreements. And we found that these tools, these site-specific tools, have been very useful. Some of the tools that we have are comfort / status letters. That original policy was written in 1996 and is still in effect today. And we've utilized it at CERCLA and CERCLA like sites, as well as RCRA sites and brownfield sites, state lead sites. And we also have this initiative in my office called ER3, which is environmentally responsible redevelopment and reuse, and that's the Empire Canyon was our first site like that. With respect to comfort / status letters, the intent of that policy was to, because we knew we couldn't issue a no action assurance, and we knew that that it wouldn't be effective to enter into prospective purchaser agreements at all these sites, because a lot of these sites are not even on of federal interest. They're not on our radar screen. We're not interested in the sites. We're not going to become involved because the states or local entities are overseeing the cleanup or overseeing whatever action needs to happen at that site. So by providing comfort, we felt that, or by providing these letters, we felt we provided comfort to these parties, so that they could take these letters to the bank and say, hey, look, the federal government's not interested in this site. Could we get a loan and so we can redevelop this site? We found that these letters have been very helpful to clean up and reuse sites. We've issued thousands of these letters, I'm sure, at this point in time. We found that they've been very useful in facilitating reuse. We also have, if you could turn to slide 28, BSPP doing work agreements. This is what we entered into at the Empire Canyon site, and it's been a useful tool. The BSPP receives liability protection in exchange for doing work. And
again, this is just a reminder. Those of you that are on the phone line, I'm going to ask one last time, please mute your line. I can hear a number of people coughing. I can hear entry and exit tones for other phone systems. Again, is either use your own mute button or hit *6 to mute your phones. And I apologize for the disruption. If I can't get the beeping to stop, I'm going to globally mute all of the phone lines. So my apologies. I have a feeling that someone is not going to globally mute that line, so if you can bear with me, I'm going to hit a command to globally mute all phone lines. You'll hear a message that the lines have been muted. I'll need our speakers to hit the command *6 so that you can continue talking through the global mute once you hear that message. So please bear with me.
The leader has muted your line. To unmute your line, press *6.
So again, I have globally muted the lines. I would ask that our presenters go ahead and use the command *6 to unmute your line. Only the presenters should do so at this time. And as soon as you have unmuted your phone line, go ahead and let me know that you're there so you can carry on with the presentation. Again, Elizabeth, if you're on the line, it's *6, and then you should be able to talk through the global mute. Elizabeth, are you still with us?
Jean?
Yep, I can hear you.
Can you hear me?
I can. Thank you very much. Again, I apologize. You can continue on. I think you're on slide number 28.
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Sorry.
No worries.
I had to hit *6 a couple of times. It didn't seem to work the first time, so sorry about that.
No. No problem.
Anyway, okay, as I mentioned, we have BSPP doing work agreements where, in the case of Empire Canyon, we entered into this agreement, and they, in exchange for covenant not to sue for existing contamination and contribution protection and a waiver windfall lien, they were able to, we got them to clean, to take on the additional cleanup of the site and also to reuse the site in an extremely sustainable and green way. And that's been a very, very successful tool. Finally, we have... our ER3 initiative, which the goal of that is to engage developers and property owners to implement sustainable practices during the reuse of contaminated sites. And ER3 also includes OSWR's Green Remediation Initiative, and which is part of that is to utilize renewable energy in the cleanup of contamination as well. So some of the incentives, this is not all, but two of the most prominent incentives are these comfort slash status letters and prospective purchaser agreements. We've had success in several areas. In addition to these tools, some of the another, I think, quite vibrant tool is also these just partnerships, like, for example, with LoRa, and other agencies where we can get people to focus on reuse goals at a particular community. So we've had success in Muskegon Heights to create this sustainable neighborhood, and working with our ER3 partners and the key stakeholders there, we've also been able to utilize our enforcement tools to clean up a former storage yard. And there we entered into a prospective purchaser agreement, and they, the developer agreed to clean up the site and provide oversight costs and incorporate green features into the design, construction, and operation, and meeting LEED silver standards for commercial buildings. So that was a really positive, great success story as well. Going on to slide 30, these are just some examples of tools that we've had, that we have in our office. One is the top 10 questions of when buying Superfund site, and that's just a little, few-page document that has some questions and answers. And then the document on the right on slide 30 is revitalizing contaminated sites, and it's actually gone through several iterations. It started off as the Brownfields Handbook, and now it's revitalizing contaminated sites. And the covers have changed over the years as well. And this is a document that we continue to update and with our new enforcement discretion policies and any legislative changes that occur and new initiatives, et cetera. So it's a great little tool that provides general information. As Laura mentioned, some of the next steps, we're hoping to get together this summer and look at our existing tools and see where and what we can tailor to the renewable energy community. One thing that came out of the liability fact sheet that was on a previous slide was that some of the regional and state folks had some really, really great ideas. My colleague Matt Sander compiled the list, and so that's something that Laura and I will take a look at as well and see if any of those make sense to work on in the upcoming year to address some of the liability issues. We're going to continue to do outreach like this this opportunity, and we're interested in getting out the message through additional case studies. And if you have any case studies you'd like to put forward, we'd love to, Laura and I would love to help you advertise those. As some of you may know, that recent House and Senate bills have included language that may broaden the brownfield grant program at specific to renewable energy projects. And so there are several things going on in the in our office as well. So slide 32 are just some of the websites that you might find helpful. The website to my office is on the top and ER3. And then slide 33 is my contact information. I've also included two other members who work on brownfields, renewable energy, and ER3 with me, Phil Page and Matt Sander. So that's it. Thank you very much.
Okay, great. And this is a reminder, on slide number 34, we're going to transition over to our next speaker. Amy, if you were on mute, you may have to hit #6 to unmute your line so you can continue with your presentation. Are you with us, Amy? Again, I can hear you pushing buttons. If you're unmuting your line, keep trying to talk to us, Amy, because, again, it should be #6 to unmute your line. If you've also used your own mute button on the phone, remember you may need to turn that off as well before you use the #6 command.
Hello? Can you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you. Is that you, Amy?
All right, great. Slide 34, I start. My name is Amy Voisin Shea. I'm the manager of site development and compliance for the WMECO Solar Program. Today I'm going to talk to you about my experiences, the challenges and opportunities I've had over the last few years to develop renewable energy on marginal use properties. So if you can move to slide 35 for me. One of the first questions we usually get asked is, why are we doing solar in Massachusetts? Basically, the Commonwealth has very, very aggressive RPS objectives that require a huge expansion into the renewable energy resources in Massachusetts. Their predictions right now will be that there's a large shortfall in renewables in Massachusetts. So Massachusetts has set up expansive goals, particularly for solar, supported by enabling policy. 250 megawatts of solar by 2017, an RPS carve-out, and a robust SREC market. Some towns also have by-right zoning to help facilitate solar development. I haven't been lucky enough to have been able to develop in one of those cities yet, but I'm hopeful. With these progressive policies and progress notwithstanding, we're still predicting, as you can see from the graph there, 3,000 megawatt shortfall by 2020. We see marginal use properties as an abundant and ideal resource for development of these larger scale properties. The Commonwealth alone has over 490 landfills with 5,000 acres of renewable energy potential. And there are numerous other brownfields that are ripe for development as well. If you can move with me to slide 36. WMECO's solar program started back in August of 2009. The DPU approved our program. It was the first and largest of its kind in Massachusetts. It's utility-owned and operated, but our customers receive the energy values from the facilities. Our focus is strictly on landfills, brownfield, and utility-owned properties. Our key objective here is to prove that larger-scale projects offer economies of scale and thereby lower the installation costs. A lot of the costs are fixed, regardless of whether it's a half a megawatt project or 2 megawatt project. For instance, all the legal fees associated with getting easements or leases, some of the site preparation work, some of the interconnection work. So by spreading that out over a larger project, we're able to reduce our cost per kilowatt, which makes these projects feasible for us. We've also tried to use extensively regional industry, our civil, our engineering, our EPC. All those are regional resources that we're using right now, and getting those through a competitive bidding process has helped us reduce costs and create efficiencies. There are also a lot of community benefits to doing these projects in Massachusetts. We're using these brownfield and landfill sites, creating a lot of positive for the communities that we've been in. For instance, our first project in Pittsfield used to be a General Electric plant, which pulled out of Pittsfield in the 70s. At the time it pulled out, it employed approximately 60% of the town occupants. So the city was really hard hit by that GE pulling out of there. So it allowed us to go back in and take this property that had this negative connotation for such a long time. It actually used to be called Silver Lake, the lake that never freezes. I don't know if that's actually true, but that was the connotation that the townsfolk had about that lake. So to go from that to now it's a green facility has been a really positive change, and we've seen a lot of great feedback from the city about what that's done for them. So that's been really helpful. It also created a lot of jobs. We created 48 full-time skilled construction jobs during the construction of the plant, and it's providing a lot of tax revenue for the city, approximately $150,000 annually to the city of Pittsfield for a facility that basically uses no town services. So they see that as a win-win, and they were very helpful in moving this project along for us. So you can now go to slide 37 with me. Our first project in Pittsfield here, the left half, the larger half, are 8 acres that is Omeco-owned property. The 2 acres to the right are property part of the Pittsfield Economic Development property, which was the former part of the former GE facility. And you can see in the middle there is our substation. So we've created a little substation sandwich there. Both of these sites have very long history of environmental issues. There were extremely complicated permitting processes required to develop on these projects. Basically, that was our biggest liability, was how are the environmental conditions and the permitting complexities associated with these properties going to affect the scope, the schedule, and the cost of this project. But we were able to work with the towns and kind of come up with some creative ideas or variances that we needed from the towns to be able to make these things profitable. One example is because it was utility zoned, any development that we put in was supposed to be screened, because they were assuming that it would be like an ugly power plant or something like that. It's not that all power plants are ugly, but they assumed that it would be something that you'd want people not to see. And we wanted this to be something that people saw, so we had to work to get that screening requirement taken off, because otherwise if you put trees in front of solar, basically you have to move it back. It would have had to shrink the project by so much that it would no longer have been economically feasible to build it because of the shading issues. So it's important to work with the towns and think about ways to work around some of the existing, and make them understand the solar process and how it works. And the towns were, like I said, the towns we've dealt with so far have been very willing to work with us and understand our issues. Moving to the next slide, which is slide 39. I can't see the number. 38. The first, we'll talk about our property, the Omeco side. We've had this property for over 100 years. It used to have a coal-fired power plant on it, and then in the 70s we had 3 jet turbines on the property. In the 1980s we did have a large jet fuel release. Approximately 20,000 gallons were released from underground piping between the tank and the turbine. So we, for the next 20 years, actively remediated that site. We had a pump and treat system for 10 years and then an air sparging system. Just before we went into to think about using this property for solar, the active remediation was actually closed out. We never really used the site for much. It was a pole laydown area. They play a big parking lot. During construction, we actually filed what's called in Massachusetts an activity and use limitation. Basically, it's a restriction on the property that limits it from future use for things like child care or agricultural uses. And that actually fit, that use, activity use limitation fit really well with solar, because we knew obviously we weren't going to put a daycare in the middle of our solar field. So that worked really well for us. And as you can see from this picture on the bottom, there were a lot of existing monitoring wells for the groundwater that had to be retrofitted and designed around. But we were able to do that, just keeping them low profile. They're still able to access them under the panels. So that was a creative way around dealing with those wells. We're going to move to the next slide, which is talking about slide 39, talking about the PETA property. This is, again, the former GE property. It was a Superfund site. It was a pilot redevelopment, now called the William Stanley Business Park. We are the first tenants of the William Stanley Business Park. When we got there, basically, they had just finished remediating the property. The grass was just starting to grow, and new baby trees had been planted, which have now been relocated elsewhere, but they're still around. The site had some pretty severe environmental restrictions, which limited our constructability. We had to kind of design and build a PV plant without excavation. So we were able to do that, but there were a lot of intricacies and details that had to be gone through, so I'll talk a little bit about some of those. One of the ways that we sort of limited the contractors from going in and just kind of bulldozing and digging up was we put a sort of a, I guess you'd call it like a tax on the amount that we would charge them per ton of soil removed. So we put like a $500 per ton cost, which is quite excessive, but the point was to let them know that we really didn't want them digging in the soil. So if they were going to propose digging in the soil, it was going to make their bid kind of look, it would be off. And in fact, only one person proposed digging in the soil, and their bid was extremely high because they were digging the soil. So that worked out really well. The contract that we actually signed, there was no excavation, was a requirement of that contract. So that was how we limited some of our liability on the PV side of construction. The only place we had to dig, and this was done by the civil contractor who actually did the remediation on the project, we hired the same contractor to go in and dig a fence post, our fence post, and one light per side. So that was the only excavation that was performed. Everything else, you can see from this top photo here, it's not exactly our ballast, but that's the type of system we had. It just basically sits on the ground. In our case, we have gravel underneath, but it's a similar system. We didn't allow any digging within the top 6 feet, basically the or below the top 6 feet. Within the environmental restriction easements that are tied to the PETA property, there are limitations on based on the depth and how deep you go. So the top 6 feet, you're allowed to dig, but below that, we didn't allow any digging. The site work, again, was performed by qualified remediation contractors. There were very strict notification and timelines associated with the environmental restriction easement. Basically, any time we were planning on digging, like if it's a fence and a light post, we had to let them know 10 days before. We had to have LSP oversight as part of that process. We could only have any hole open for 14 days. We then had to provide a letter 30 days after that with photos and signed by the LSP that said that we followed the ERE restrictions. So those intricacies created a lot of scenes that we had to follow and manage, but ultimately we were able to do that. We also had, again, just like on our side, provide access for future groundwater monitoring. There are a few wells on the PETA side as well. We'll now move to slide 40. Another fun part of both of these parcels were that the majority of both of the parcels was within the 100-year floodplain. And because we wanted to maximize the size of the system to, again, keep the cost down, there was no place really for us to dig a big pond and get that compensatory storage. So what we had to do was acquire the required compensatory storage credits from the neighboring property. As part of their redesign of the property, they had created a large stormwater retention basin and had access credits. So the town allowed us to sort of acquire those credits through a permitting process. But we had to determine how much compensatory storage we would need. So it required us on a foot-by-foot basis in the floodplain to look at how many racks there were, how big the racks were, how big the ballasts were. It had to go down to the detailed level of looking at each conduit run and how thick it was and what the circumference was and determining and making sure that we had enough compensatory storage in case there ever was a flood. So by the end of that process, our engineers were none too happy with me, but we were able to do it and allow the project to go forward. So that was critical. The area was also in a wetland buffer, so we had to go through the whole NOI and order of conditions, which we followed, throughout construction. We had to have special variances, again, for, that screening and reducing of the setback. One area we wanted to reduce the setback because the two properties are part of the same project. It didn't really make sense to have a setback in between them. So we got a variance for that. We also got a variance on the height of the fence because we wanted it to be higher to allow for security protection. So we got variances on those things. It was, you know, cumbersome, time-consuming, you know, local permitting process, but ultimately we were able to get it done and make the project happen. And we'll just slide 41. Obviously the Munico side is our own, so we didn't need any type of lease arrangement or anything like that for that. But on the other side, the PETA side, how we were able to use the property was through a surface rights-only easement. And that allowed us to limit our subsurface liability. Basically, anything that was pre-existing remained with PETA. Anything that we created, obviously, would be our issue. And one of the good things about the type of PV system that we used is that it's a fixed tilt. It has no moving parts. There's no oils or anything physically on the PETA property. There are some transformers, but that's actually on the substation property. So future liability is pretty minor, so it's not a big concern for us. The surface rights easement that we signed was very, very strict on making sure that we complied with the environmental restriction easements that are on the property. That was, again, something we had to really follow and keep an eye on. There were some encumbrances on the property. There was an existing sewer line, so we had to look at the possibility of having to relocate our panels in the future or either not building over that at this time. So we did decide to build over it because the line is really not an operational line and unlikely that they will ever have to go through it and work on it. We also had to get see the maxes for the groundwater monitoring and get a solar easement, which allowed us rights to unobstructed sunlight. Like I said, this is a large business park, or future business park. We had to look at the zoning and the building requirements that were going to be placed on any future buyer of the property or leasee, just to make sure that, you know, they weren't going to put a 200-foot-tall building right in front of our solar array. So we looked at those issues. We did shading analysis and made sure that the property owners could live with what restrictions we were going to place on the height of the buildings and that worked with their potential future development of that property. During this whole thing, there was another twist thrown at us. Part of the GE redevelopment plan, which is a consent order from EPA, was that they had to perform this basically called a beautification plan. The area along the front of Silver Lake, across the street from our solar facility, we found that we actually owned. We didn't know that at the time, but we actually owned it, and GE was going to go in and beautify that as part of their consent order. Unfortunately, their plan for beautification involved in planting trees that can grow to a mature height of 100 to 150 feet just across the street from our solar facility. So that would have created quite a bit of shading because it was on the south side of our project. So we had to talk to GE, the EPA, the city, and we had to all get them to agree to changing the beautification plan to include no longer the really tall trees, but low-growing trees that won't exceed 20 feet, because that was sort of the cap of where how high it could be before it started to create shadow impacts for us. So we had to sit down with everybody and get that process moving. And everybody agreed, and the plan was modified, and we're actually transferring that property to GE. So that was a good thing, but it was good to know that that was our property. Unfortunately, it would have been better for us to know that earlier, but it all worked out. So we'll move on to slide 42. Even though we limited excavating and soil disposal, in order to reduce our liability, we did have to excavate inside of our own substation in order to perform the interconnection. And unfortunately, when we performed the necessary test pits, we did have reportable levels of PCBs within our substation. The substation, like the property, has been around for hundreds of years, so, you know, it's almost a given in our industry to find some contamination when you start poking around, especially in that area. So because we found these reportable levels, we had to initiate two formal cleanup actions, a limited removal action, and a performance-based cleanup. We delineated and disposed of over 100 tons of PCB-contaminated soils and concrete. Concrete proved to be the harder to get rid of because of the size of the concrete. We actually had to segregate it because of the size and levels of contamination. We had to segregate it into four different piles, which then had to go to four different facilities based on the contaminants. So that whole process of sampling and arranging for disposal took us several weeks, and it was costly. And it kind of proved to us that by minimizing digging and excavation on the other parts of the property was a really good idea, because just having this one small piece where we absolutely had to dig, it ended up costing us several weeks and a lot of money. So if we had done that throughout all these properties and just said, yeah, go ahead, dig trenches and bury, you know, you never know what you can come across, which is one of the, you know, it's a challenge with developing, you know, these marginal use properties is you don't know what you're going to find. So, you know, prevention is sort of the best medicine, I guess, is what we sort of came up with after this project. So that's kind of been our and will be our goal moving forward, too, is to try to minimize the amount of excavation we do on any of these properties. We'll move to the next slide. Even though we did minimize excavation, we still found a few things. And I have to, like to point out, these are all on the LMECO side of the property. These are not the GE side. So sometimes you don't even know what's in your own backyard. We did run into a sinkhole on point during compaction. We also found a buried drum. I will point out the drum looks really big in the picture, but it's really it was a 30-gallon, very small drum, and the leak was less than 2 gallons. If anybody from the Mass TEP is on the line, it's not a reportable. It was not a reportable spill. We had an electrical conduit, which you'd think we'd know was there, but it was very old and inactive, so we did not know it was there. And in the bottom right-hand corner picture, you can see where we put in this nice decorative fence, and somebody crashed through it within a month of it being up. The other fences there were probably 30 years, and nobody ever touched it. And actually, it's been crashed into again. So apparently, decorative fences are very distracting in Pittsfield. So we put up one on our next project, too, so we'll see what happens. I'm waiting for that call. It just went up last week. So go to the next slide, slide number 44. Even though there were some challenges associated with this developing this project, there were also a lot of great opportunities. It allowed us to work with regulators and develop relationships that LMECO hopes will help facilitate the success of our future renewable projects. It proved that this level of complexity, I think we almost hit everything that we had. So, you know, we've proven that this level of complexity can be resolved and that we can limit the company's liability and complete the projects under budget and on schedule. And like I said, now we're comfortable that we can do these projects going forward. A big part, that what we see as a critical success factor to development of solar on these types of projects as a whole is collaboration between energy policy, whether it's the DPU or the AG's office, the compliance and permitting at the federal, state, and local level, working on local ordinances, buy rate zoning, things to help kind of jump through some of those local permitting hurdles that kind of held us up. And then just balancing PV design with environmental restrictions, coming up with some creative designs that we can use on these type of properties. So I think, you know, if we leverage any of these, either all of these factors or some of these factors, it can really move things forward in the development of marginal use properties. So we're kind of hoping that we can help move some of those things forward so that these type of projects can continue to happen for us and for others as well. I'll move on to slide 45. Where are we today? The construction activities at our Pittsfield project began in early June 2010. We were fully operational by December 2010. We're currently the largest operating solar facility in New England. I'm sure that can change probably by the minute because they're going up crazy. We are now in site preparation on our second solar project. It's a 2.28 megawatt facility in Springfield. We're pretty close to starting PV construction. The Pittsfield project was 1.8 megawatts, and it cost us about $9.5 million to build that property. So I look forward to being able to share our next project with you. My contact information is on page 46. If you have any questions that I can answer, feel free to shoot me an email or give me a call, and I think I'm done now.
Okay, great. Thank you so very much. So that is the
collection of formal presentation materials that we have available. And at this time, we want to open up and turn to questions from both our phone participants as well as the streaming simulcast. And I do have a number of questions that were submitted electronically. I'm going to start with people on the phones, though, and then we'll continue. We'll switch over to the streaming simulcast questions. So if you're listening to the audio online, you can continue to type up your questions. Do know we have a queue, and I'll be reading them out loud so we can get answers in just a few moments. We do have about 275 people on the line today from all over the country. So I'm going to try to facilitate the phone questions by starting in certain time zones. And I'm going to start out in the West Coast. So if you are all the way across the country on the West Coast and have a question on the phone lines, you can hit #6 to unmute your line. Remember, you may have to locally use your own unmute button, too, if you used that earlier. And feel free to identify yourself or organization and ask a question for one of our presenters today. Okay, let's move back towards the East Coast, and we're going to start in the Mountain Time Zone. Anyone in Mountain Time Zone have a question on the phones? Again, it's #6. We do ask you to identify yourself or organization and ask your question.
I'm sorry, this is Dawn. I'm on phone West Coast. When you come back to the West Coast on the phone, let me
know. It's okay. Donna, go ahead. You can ask your question.
I'm Donna House with Genic Hair. I was wondering if EPA had any examples, and if they do, what are the barriers in working with tribes and brownfields?
This is Lubra. I don't know of any examples of renewable energy on contaminated tribal land. Two of the feasibility studies they're working with NREL on are on tribal land. However, those are both wind studies, so we're still in sort of the earlier stages of putting up the anemometer. So I'm afraid I don't have any examples of renewable energy on tribal lands. Elizabeth, do you have any enforcement examples?
No, I was just trying to think if I know there were some discussions out west about doing some things, but I don't know if any, I don't recall that anything's come to fruition yet.
Yeah, I do know of some tribes who are looking to put renewable energy on contaminated lands, but, you know, I think right now it's kind of difficult for tribes to have their projects be profitable because they can't get the, you know, some of the incentives from the federal government, but I think DOE is trying to work on that. So hopefully we'll have some examples in the future.
Okay, great. Let's move back and see if there's anybody in the Mountain Time Zone that has a question on the phones.
Hi, Laura. My name is Tim Estep. I work for Freeport MacMoran, Chino and Tyrone Operations. In New Mexico, southern New Mexico. I'm wondering, a while back you had the applications due, I think it's May 20th, for the mine site feasibility studies. And wondering about the timing on, sorting through the list of applications and awarding those.
We hope to make the announcement in September or October for the next round of feasibility studies.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Okay, great. Let's go ahead and move over to the Central Time Zone. If anyone in Central Time Zone on the phone lines has a question, again, it's #6. You may have to use your own unmute button as well, and we do ask you to identify yourself or organization before asking a question. Okay, we'll go ahead and move to the East Coast. Anyone on the East Coast time zone have a question on the phones? Again, #6. You may have to unmute your phone as well, and then go ahead and identify yourself or organization.
I'm trying to jump in from Mountain Time.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, I'm on in the city of Dewey, Humboldt, Arizona, where we have a Superfund site that is mainly a large amount of mine tailings right next to. the city, and we're really interested in bringing in some renewable energy. But a question I have is, all of the PRPs have claimed they have absolutely no money. And I was just wondering if there are ways to talk to them about, these are some businesses that actually could do something renewable. And so we work closely with EPA, of course, and I was just wondering if there are ways to lure people back into the discussions by having, you know, presenting these opportunities to them and getting access to some of their funds, because they are not, none of them are bankrupt or gone. They just say they have no money.
Sure. Well, I think there are a couple sort of tools that we have, and Elizabeth may have some other ideas too, but some of the benefits of reusing these sites for renewable energy, the potentially responsible parties or owners of the property might not have thought of. You know, they may be able to get some leasing revenue from the site. It may make a good PR story for the property. Also, by having solar or wind on the site and then having a fence around that, it actually is protecting whatever remedy the you know, the potentially responsible party spent millions of dollars you know, designing and implementing. So there are a couple you know, sort of tools that we have to you know, let the potentially responsible parties know that there is some benefit to them for reusing the property for renewable energy. So I don't know if Elizabeth and Amy have other thoughts to add.
I'll suggest that to EPA, as I think they're still talking to these businesses, and hopefully we can lure them in to be part of the solution. Thank you.
Hi, this is Elizabeth. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, to answer your question, I think if EPA is involved, if this is a federal Superfund site, then just because somebody says they don't have any money, they still have to prove that that they can't afford cleanup. But one of the ways in which we could settle with them is that they could do in-kind work. So they might settle for a certain dollar amount, but also they're going to do certain actions there, which could include the installation of renewable energy. So I think that's a fine way to address. So definitely work with your which state are you in?
In Arizona, but it's Region 9.
Region 9.
Very helpful. Nine. They are promoting solar at this site. And it is looking good for that. But, you know, we're going to need to be able to afford the entire cleanup. So I'll suggest that this in-kind participation could be helpful.
Yeah, and if you'd like Laura and me to follow up on that, just
can I give them your names? I'll say
yeah,
I was on this call.
Yeah, or you can email us with the Region 9 contacts, and Laura and I would be happy to contact them and see if there's anything we could do to help.
Okay, so this is Laura and Elizabeth.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, again, one last call for the East Coast time zone. Any phone questions? Okay, we have still about 10 minutes left with our scheduled seminar time. So with that, I'm going to turn to the submitted questions that have come in online. I'm going to start reading through them, and if we have enough time, we'll go back to the phone lines for any subsequent questions. Again, starting with a streaming simulcast participant question, this one's coming in from Honolulu, Hawaii. They ask, have all sites been mapped for the state of Hawaii? I found that there are very few sites that are visible.
We have only, this is Lura, we've only mapped those contaminated sites in Hawaii that we have in our EPA database. So those would be most of the Superfund and RCRA sites, but they would only be those brownfield sites where EPA has given a cleanup or an assessment grant, and that's the case for all the states. So one thing we're working on doing is looking to add sites from state databases of their brownfield sites and state track Superfund sites. A lot of states have contaminated site data available online. They usually have like a state cleanup information database. And those sites haven't been screened for renewable energy potential, but you may be able to go in there and do some of your own screening. So if you can often Google that to find the state database. And if you have any trouble, you know, just send me an email and I can help track that down for you. And then hopefully in, you know, the fall or the winter, we'll have a number of states' data in our database.
Okay, great. You may have addressed this question already, but I just want to ask it in case it's a different timeline. This question is coming in from Vermont, and they say that they recently submitted an application for technical assistance from NREL or NREL through the Repowering Feasibility Study Program. They'd like to know what the timeline is for making a decision about these applications and then notifying the applicants.
That is the same application process that we had on the phone, so that's expected in September or October.
Okay, great. The next question comes in from New York, and they ask, of the sites examined so far by the NREL, have any of them been small urban sites, for example, rooftop solar?
Certainly lots of the properties are small urban sites. We do have the acreage in our database, so you can look and see how many sites there are small acreage. We have not particularly looked at sites for rooftop solar potential, even though the sites, even if a site is on a brownfield, there's really nothing different about putting solar on the roof of a brownfield as opposed to putting solar on the roof of a site that's on a, you know, pristine land. It really gets a little more complicated when you're putting the renewable energy structure on the contaminated land itself. So that's what we're focusing on with repowering. For, you know, we do have our brownfields program and our Superfund program revitalization efforts, and they, you know, are happy to help with any type of site redevelopment. But the repower initiative is just focused on renewable energy on the contaminated land itself.
Okay, great. Again, that feedback, if you're on the phones and you are not asking a question, please mute your line. It's *6 to go back onto mute. This next question comes in from Grand Junction, Colorado, and they ask, does your site-specific analysis look at the receptiveness of the local utility to purchasing the energy from the project?
Yes. Not where we looked at all 11,000 sites for renewable energy potential, but when we're doing feasibility studies with NREL, it does look at the state and local incentives as well as the utility incentives and gets into, you know, does it seem likely that the utility is going to be involved in the project. And some of them were even going a little further to, you know, engage with the utility and try to work through projects with them as the feasibility study itself is wrapping up.
Okay, great. Our next question is coming in from Boston, Massachusetts, and they ask, is the 6 megawatt the maximum output for 40 acres? Could we use this ratio to predict output per acreage?
I don't think that's the max. There's, you know, there's a range of amount of megawatts per acres, and I think that's sort of in the middle of it. I don't know what that range is. Amy, do you know that number?
We usually think about 5 acres a megawatt because you have to consider setbacks, and usually there's some kind of road that needs to be developed. So usually about 5 acres per megawatt is what we get. But it also depends on your system and how tight you pack them in. So it all depends. You know, it varies, but that's a general rule.
Okay, great. Our next question is coming in from Allison Park, Pennsylvania, and they ask, what incentives exist for the persons responsible for remediating contaminated sites for entering into these types of reuse opportunities. In other words, if the reuse opportunity is implemented, then the remedial action also changes, which interferes with the reuse opportunity. So how is that handled?
Go ahead, Elizabeth.
I was just going to say, well, I think Laura and I found the opposite to happen, that because renewable energy is a target, now we're able to look at the cleanup holistically and incorporate the renewable energy reuse into cleanup. And so rather than looking at existing zoning regulations and laws and potential ideas that the community might have, we're able to take something specific and focus the cleanup towards that goal rather than a potential goal. And also, I think we found that by targeting renewable energy, we're able to not only expedite cleanup, but also consolidate costs. So it actually ends up being cheaper, a cheaper cleanup because of the consolidation and a more effective cleanup as well. Go ahead, Laura. What do you want to add?
I'll just add that, you know, I think it's, as Elizabeth said, it's really up to the community how they want to plan the redevelopment of the site. And when you have a specific end use in mind, like renewable energy, that often helps the process for deciding what the remedial action and the cleanup will be. You know, additionally, there are restrictions on how some sites can be used. And those sites that have restrictions, as Amy was mentioning about the Pittsfield site where you can't build a daycare on that site. It's sites like those that are probably going to be more attractive for renewable energy, sites that are cleaned up and don't have restrictions on them and are in urban areas where there's lots of development. Those sites are probably going to be used, you know, for more profitable endeavors, you know, like shopping malls, you know, residences.
Okay, great. It looks like we still have a couple of questions. We are coming up on the scheduled conclusion time of 3:30, but we still have a few minutes left, and I may push us to go a few minutes over so we can try to address all the questions. So I appreciate everyone if you can bear with us. The next question is coming in online from Sacramento, California, and they state, solar PV on landfill projects often involves a long-term ground lease from the municipality that is often also a liable party for the waste in the landfill. Can you expand on the BFPP protections that may or may not be available to leases of, or lessees of these closed landfills for municipalities that may also be RPs?
I'm not quite sure I understand the question. So if the person who asked it wants to contact me offline, if I don't answer it the way you're happy with, feel free to contact me. The beauty of the BFPP provision is that it's given to folks who are not responsible for the contamination. So it's not the lessee component isn't an issue. It's just if the lessee is a responsible party, then we wouldn't enter into a BFPP agreement with that person. I'm sorry, Jean, could you read the question again?
Sure. Again, they state solar PV on landfill projects often involve a long-term ground lease from the municipality that is often also a liable party for the waste in the landfill. Can you expand on the BFPP protections that may or may not be available to lessees of these closed landfills for municipalities that may also be RPs?
Okay. All right. I understand now. All right. If the lessee would be responsible, it would be the municipality that would be responsible for the cleanup. So what we would do is enter into a lessee agreement, a BFPP agreement with the lessee. So this would be the developer of the renewable energy project, and
are you still with us, Elizabeth?
I'm sorry, Jean, do you not hear me?
Yeah,
hello?
You got cut off a little bit. Go ahead, I can still hear you.
Okay. So what I was saying, I'm sorry if I'm repeating what I just said. I'm just not sure where I got cut off. We would enter into agreement with the lessee, who I'm assuming is the renewable energy developer, and the municipality would still retain their liability. So as long as the lessee could, there were some stipulations that are outlined in the slides, so as long as the lessee maintained the integrity of the remedy and didn't contribute to the contamination or didn't exacerbate the contamination while using the site, then there shouldn't be a problem.
Okay, great. Thank you. Our next question comes in from Madison, Wisconsin, and they ask, is there a fee charged for an EPA comfort / status letter? If so, how much?
Oh, no. No fee.
Okay, great. Our next question is coming in from Washington, D.C., and they ask, is there a minimum contamination level that these sites must achieve prior to utilizing them for repowering sites, or do the contaminant cleanup levels vary from site to site?
It can vary from site to site. So as I mentioned before, there might be sites where the contamination has been completely removed or sites where the contamination is left in place.
Excellent. Again, our next comment or question is coming in from Washington, D.C., and they state that there's lots of offshore wind potential in the Great Lakes, and there's a critical need for large coastal sites for turbine assembly, launching into water, and related tasks. How do I locate brownfield sites on lake shores that might be suitable?
So you could use the Google Earth tool to go in and search along the lakeshore, and, you know, as I said, there are a lot of state sites that aren't going to be in those databases. So the state may have a database you could look at. Also, most cities, especially larger ones, have like a brownfield program or at least a brownfield coordinator. And so if you have specific cities along the Great Lakes you're interested in, you could, you know, just talk to those city brownfield folks and they'll know all the sites and say like, oh yeah, that one would be good. Or, you know, no, that one has another use. So, you know, if you want to send me an email or give me a call, I can help talk to you, you know, about how to access the state database or find some contacts at those city offices.
Okay, great. We're going to take a few more questions online, and then we'll wrap things up today. I don't want to keep two people too long this afternoon. So our next question that we'll take online is coming in from Boston, Massachusetts, and they ask, has a similar initiative been established in New Hampshire or any of the other New England states?
I guess I'm not sure if they mean a similar incentive that Massachusetts has, or if they mean something else. But I think the map with the that I showed in one of my earlier slides, 7, shows how many states in the Northeast have solar incentives that have solar incentives. So you can look at that, and I think in addition to Massachusetts, New Hampshire does. And I think Maine and Vermont are working on some renewable energy standards. I think Vermont just passed the law recently, so I think that one might be coming online as well.
Okay, great. I'm going to take one more question online. For the ones that we were unable to address with the time we have allotted, we'll pass those questions on to our speakers so they'll be able to follow up with you offline. And again, we'll provide contact information for everyone before we close out so that if you didn't get a question in on the phone lines, you'll know how to contact our speakers to ask your question later on. But the final question that I'm going to take came in online. Again, this is coming in from Denver, Colorado. It's a multi-part question. And they ask first, what are the issues with leasing of Superfund site land for renewables, for example, solar installation?
Oh, you're taking them one at a time. I think leasing a Superfund site, you know, as Elizabeth went through in her materials, it's not, you know, necessarily more difficult than purchasing a Superfund site. So you can get BFP protection as a lessee. And I think you can find out more about that in the fact sheet. And because Superfund sites are sites that EPA works on, you know, you'll have a good partner at EPA to help work through any issues you have. So all of our Superfund sites have a regional contact or regional contacts who work on those sites. And so I can help put you in touch with those folks for any site you're interested in.
Okay. The next part of their question asks, are there liability protections that can be put in place for the solar leasee and operator, such as a case that may arise from Colorado's Solar Garden Initiative?
Yes. So, yeah, I think any solar lessee can get the BFPP protection as long as they, you know, follow the provisions Elizabeth mentioned.
Okay. And the last question, so coming in from Denver, asks, does the property owner have sole responsibility to protect themselves from exacerbation of contaminant migration due to the activities associated with the operation of a solar installation on a leased land?
Elizabeth, do you want to answer that one?
Well, that's kind of confusing because they mention lessee and then they mention property owner. Does the property owner have sole responsibility? Who is ever responsible for the contamination has responsibility. If the lessee comes along to use the site to in some renewable energy context, then we can separate the future liability of the lessee from the past liability, and so in that sense that the property owner has responsibility. However, the lessee has responsibilities too, because they can't exacerbate, they can't cause a breach of the remedy, and if they do, then that kicks them out of the BFPP status.
Okay, great. So I appreciate everyone's question submission as well as the speakers for taking their time to address the questions. Again, we are coming up on 3:40 Eastern, so we are several minutes past our scheduled end time. What I'm going to do is I'm going to stop accepting additional questions. We do have the ones that were submitted already, so if you typed up a question and we weren't able to address them, we'll share those questions along with your contact information with our presenters so they can follow up with you offline. And again, I will remind everyone how they can access contact information if you do have additional questions for our speakers, how you can get in touch with them after today's session. Before I direct everyone through the closing statements and reminders about getting copies of feedback forms and confirmation messages, I just wanted to go through our speakers and offer each one of them an opportunity to make a closing statement. So I'll start with you, Laura, if you have any final statements to make.
I just want to thank everyone for joining us today. And, you know, if you have any specific questions about repowering or specific sites, you know, please send me an email or give me a call.
And Elizabeth, any comments or closing statements?
Well, thank you very much. And please, if you have any questions, feel free to contact me. And also, if you have any suggestions on ways in which we can address liability, I'd love to hear them.
And finally, Amy, any closing comments or statements?
I'd just like to say thanks for listening to my first and first project with solar. And if there's any way that my experiences, the struggles that I've been through can make it easier for anybody else, feel free to shoot me an email and I'll try to answer your questions. Thanks.
Okay, great. Thank you. So with that, I'm going to ask everyone to move along to the final slide in today's presentation material, which is slide number 47. On that slide, you're going to see two important links. If you have a printed copy, of course, the links won't be active, but you can certainly come back to them and access the same links from the seminar homepage. The first link is an additional resources page where we have collected not only copies of the presentation materials to download, but other websites and documents that are related to today's topic. So I'd encourage you, if you have a moment or two, to go take a look at the additional resources or links page for today's seminar and review those documents and items. Again, you can access this from the bottom of the seminar homepage or from the side button that says links. The other link on slide 47 is a link to our short feedback form. It takes just a minute or two to fill it out. I do read each and every single one of those responses. So if you'd like to continue to see free online training like this offered through Kluin, we do ask that you take a minute to fill out the feedback form and let us know what you thought of today's session. If you're looking for confirmation to for your participation today, for example, for your own record keeping or for certification requirements, if you fill out the feedback form, there's a box you can check, and you can have a confirmation message sent to you that will at least confirm that you submitted feedback for this session at a particular time from a certain location. If you are sharing the line with multiple participants, each person can actually fill out that form individually and have their own confirmation message sent to them for their records. Again, if you're not at a computer with active internet right now, you can come back to that page or come back and fill out the feedback afterwards, because that form is available at the bottom of the seminar homepage and will remain open after today's live delivery. With that, I wanted to again extend our thanks to the organizers from OSWER here at EPA who helped put together today's presentation. I also want to thank all of our presenters who joined us and took time out of their busy schedules to share information and answer your questions. And I also want to thank the over 270-plus individuals who joined us from all across the country for today's Kluin seminar. I hope that you found today to be a useful expenditure of your time and that you'll join us again in the future for another session. Again, if you need to follow up with one of the presenters for a question or comment, you'll find their contact information on the seminar homepage, the same page that you may have used to sign up. You'll find detailed email as well as phone numbers for each one of our participants, or pardon me, our presenters. You'll also find my contact info. You can certainly contact me, and I'll be sure to pass your question along to the speakers. So with that, I want to thank everyone, remind you that you should receive an email from me in about 1 to 2 weeks with the links to replay a recorded version of today's session. And again, hope you all have a great rest of your day or afternoon, depending on your time zone. Thanks very much. This will be the formal conclusion of today's seminar.